Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
The Telegraph. The Telegraph. Podcasts.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the latest episode of the Telegraph Rugby Podcast. The Six Nations is done and dusted, and Ireland have won a second Grand Slam in the space of 5 years. They got there in the end against England after a few nerves, but it was an impressive performance from Andy Farrell's side. I'm Ben Coles, the Telegraph's rugby reporter, and I'm joined in the studio by Charlie Morgan. Hi, Charlie.
Hello, Ben.
And also by Charles Richardson. Hello, Charles.
Hello, everybody.
Charlie was in Dublin, Charles was in Paris, so we're going to get their insights on what was a very, very fun final day of action in the Six Nations. Charlie, if I come to you first, what was your favourite bit of your couple of days in Dublin? And please say the Guinness.
Oh, yeah. Well, that was top three.
Okay.
Can I give you an on-pitch highlight?
Yeah.
Because I actually got on the pitch.
Oh.
With the post-match media, the post-match mix zone islands. Ooh. Was pitch side. So that was a really nice, sort of felt right in the middle of a few Freed From Desire renditions,
a
bit
that.
Of the Cranberries, and yeah, that was really cool. Took a couple of videos, actually, like a real fan with a laptop, but it was fun. Yeah.
Charles, what about Paris? What did you enjoy?
On field has to be the on-20 pond pass. It's becoming cliched now. We say it every week about how amazing it is, but that pass for France's first try, I think it was, wasn't it, with Damien Penaud scoring in the corner, was just something to behold. It took my breath away. Off field, Friday night, I had the privilege to attend a reunion of the 1987 Rugby World Cup finalists. The French finalists, so Serge Blanco, Philippe Sella, Denis Chavez, the lot of them, all there, Laurent Rodriguez, all there celebrating, raising a lot of money for the Rugby World Cup 2023 charity. And it was a fantastic evening in the Hôtel de Ville in the centre of Paris. And that was, yeah, memories that will stay with me for a long time, I think.
How are they? Are they all well?
Yeah, very well. Oh, yeah, looking very well. Very, very well. Serge Blanco looks very well. He enjoys himself.
Okay.
Hope you're listening, Serge.
Okay, I'm glad. I'm very glad to hear it. Just a quick word before we dive into the Ireland-England game. The tournament as a whole, I think we sort of agreed between us chatting over the weekend, has been one of the best Six Nations, I think, certainly in the top bracket. Charlie, would you say? Is it right up there?
Yeah. So Ireland and France brought the ceiling up and Italy brought the floor up, right? So I know England and Wales were sort of struggling in the middle of that make-believe house that I've just made up. But that was, good. It was a good tournament overall. I think we were always going to get sides, weren't we, in a bit of a groove because of where we are in the World Cup cycle. But no, it's good.
Charles?
Yeah, I certainly think it's one of the best Six Nations that I can remember. Certainly in terms of standard of rugby, and certainly in terms of some of the matches. You think of that titanic Ireland-France match in Dublin in the second round as probably the highlight in terms of across the games. I did think Saturday was a bit deflating, though. I did leave that.
You were hungover.
I did think Saturday, I was deflated on Saturday night. I thought Scotland and Italy was a bit of a damp squib of a game. I didn't think Italy were very good at all and very underwhelming. France, Wales.
They nearly won at Murrayfield.
They nearly won at Murrayfield, but Scotland were dreadful.
Yeah,
the game as a spectacle was dreadful. I just thought both teams were quite poor, really. And I think Scotland, on that showing, Scotland did not deserve to finish third in the table. But across the tournament, obviously they did. And then France, Wales, France really never really got out of third gear. Wales started very well, and then France took their foot off the gas in the second half in a game that was eventually a dead rubber, and then a rank red card ruined the Grand Slam decider. So I think all in all, in terms of Super Saturday, I think I'd take the word super out of the Saturday's events.
Can I retrospectively add a off-field highlight?
Yeah. You said you had three and you only gave me one.
I turned around in a pub in Dublin on the Friday night and saw one of my best mates from school, who's an avid listener of this. It was lovely.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah, it was brilliant. It's like really, really, really refreshing.
Have they left
start to the weekend
a positive review under the podcast? Because those are very welcome.
I'll be nudging.
Thank you. Thank you very much, listeners. Okay, well, we've danced around it. Let's hear about what happened in Dublin and Ireland. Grand Slam champions again. Okay, we sort of hinted at it in the intro, but Ireland did start fairly nervously, Charlie. But that wasn't necessarily because, obviously, there was a lot of emotion about the game and the pressure of everyone assuming that they were just wiping in the side. But England really contributed to that, didn't they, with the way that they played?
Massively, yeah. They were early jitters, early and understandable jitters from Ireland. But we've spoken about this before, haven't we? Teams playing badly against England when they move the ball. So Japan in November, Italy earlier this tournament, Ireland going through phases. Sometimes they were scrambled by really good steely defence, but also good decision making around the breakdown from England. They generally kept players on their feet. Jack Willis was given licence to compete, and that worked well for them. They got burst a few times, as you'd expect against Ireland, but scrambled really well. And I've written a piece this morning that's gone live that is just about how this has to be an absolute baseline for England. I certainly think they contributed to just they wanted a fast start, and it didn't have to be a tone setting try like they kind of got used to under Eddie Jones, but they just had to be assertive at the start, which they were. Apart from that, me and Charles have just been speaking away from the pod about the Owen Farrell penalty, which was the first penalty in that, and England were a bit loose with their discipline, but they sort of had to be right on the edge, didn't they? Just because they were always going to be fired up and determined to kind of restore a bit of pride after that's what seems even weirder in retrospect, the performance against France.
Mm. Yeah, I was just going to say that Jack Willis, you mentioned him, had 20 tackles by half time, which I think actually broke his own record for tackles per minute or whatever, which he set earlier in the tournament against Italy, which sort of summed up what an impressive performance it was from him. And also, it was the way that they just never let Ireland sort of launch those strike plays or get the line-out base, which they really want. Through their physicality, really.
I thought there were layers to that England defensive performance. They were really hard-working and quite clever with how they went about phase play defence, clever apart from a couple of late tackles, which were kind of avoidable. I know Ireland eventually scored that that set play off the back of a maul with Dan Sheehan scoring on about the half hour mark. But there are a couple of other kind of set plays that England identified and shut down. The dummy loop that Tug Furlong's pass to Keenan was shut down, but there was cover there. And in the second half, which led to Mario Toji's kind of rumbling celebration, that was a variation on a trick play that Ireland had split England with in 2021, if you remember Keith Earls going through. So England were alert, but as I say, that just has to be non-negotiable. The pillars of that performance, how they kicked, how they defended, and then aspects of their set piece, they'll be a bit annoyed, I think, with a few line-out lapses, but that just has to be non-negotiable from here, and they actually have to layer on that pretty quickly now too.
They didn't trouble Ireland very much ball in hand, did they, from memory? Like, they had that good passage at the end of the, midway towards the end of the first half. I think Manu Tuilagi ended up getting bundled into touch, and that felt like a big moment because they'd gone through sort of maybe 10 or 15 phases there, I think.
Really big, like classic Peter Omani intervention. You kind of, it feels more significant in retrospect, but Freddie Stewart hits a line. I think England about 5-6 metres out, Freddie Stewart hits one of those kind of arcing out to win.
Like in the Prem final.
Yeah, like one of those lines. And he goes into Sexton. He tries to identify Sexton and kind of blast through Sexton. Sexton just about absorbs the impact, and Omani comes, crashes him back another couple of metres. And then that's the momentum that Ireland need. And then I think it ends with James Lowe without a hair tie,
bundling
money too.
Like, yeah. I love that. I really enjoyed that. Just seeing him sort of.
You did text me, I think.
Hairing around.
Oh, here we go.
It's there true. It just really leapt out. I mean,
last pod.
You've touched on it there, Charles, in a way. There was a sort of a vibe from England of they were going there for a street fight, in a way, and that was the way they were going to contain Ireland, and that was how they were going to win. It wasn't going to be through anything overly flash.
No, and I think they stood up. I think they stood up to the challenge, really. I think there was a real concerted difference from the France performance in terms of physicality, in terms of application, in terms of line speed. You can obviously see what they've been working on over the past week. And I do think that there was a difference there. And I think that the red cards, which we'll come on to, killed them, really. I think if Freddie Stewart hadn't been sent off, would England have won? We'll never know. But I think it would have been pretty close. As in, they had Ireland rattled. They even had Ireland rattled at the start of the second half with 14. And they held them out. That also, speaking of big moments, at the end of the first half, not allowing Ireland to score, that also felt like a big moment. With 14 men holding out the best team in the world at home, going for a Grand Slam, you felt there, oh God, they might get quite a lot of belief from this.
It felt like, so throughout that first half, it felt like England, as you say, Colsey, they'd come with a plan to disrupt and scrap and spoil, and they'd done that, again, penalties notwithstanding, in a fairly disciplined manner. If that doesn't sound stupid with the penalties. But then I think on 38, Carl Slinker comes from an offside position inside Ireland's half, so he gives away another penalty. Johnny Sexton turns around to his whole back line before he kicks the penalty into touch. So you know that England have to withstand one more strike play. Ireland go up the guts, don't they? And then they flood around, and it's a brilliant defensive read from Anthony Watson on the edge to rush Hansen into the offload that leads to the Stewart incident. But you before that penalty, you thought, right, it's one more little moment that they've got to withstand. And then they withstand that, but then concede a red card, withstand another one. And I thought actually that it kind of galvanised them a little bit, as it did last year with Charlie Yule's red card. But the problem was it was just too. And that's the thing with Ireland. England had a maul, 25 minutes to go at 10-9. And then they had another, they were on the cusp of Ireland's 22 at 10-9. About 5 minutes later, there was a big Ryan Baird jackal turnover.
He was great, by the way.
Conan was the one that got in with that, buried in with that maul and disrupted that, and Jamison Gibson-Park comes away with it. So those two turnovers, really, really big moments. And then the thing with Ireland is that they can go, like the very best elite All Black sides, they can go 7-14, 21, whatever, 5-12, 19.
Five and sevens.
They go in and sevens, and then they just snuff the life out of you, and that's what they did in that last 15 minutes.
It's not fair that Dan Sheehan is a hooker by position, because he's so fast and has acceleration, which most front rowers don't have, and that's actually the first try with the way that was created off the ball with Josh Handefleer's movement and then Sheehan's loop. I don't know if there are many other hookers who have that same burst to hit that hole as well as they did, and England weren't ready for it. Don Brant was sort of caught on his own, having to handle Van der Fleer, and suddenly there was a huge space on his inside.
Who was it who scored that one? Was it Pierre Bourgari at La Rochelle who scored that wonder try, length of the field? It's shades of him. But yeah, Sheehan in Cardiff first round looked absolutely rapid, lightning there, like quicker than I've ever seen him actually.
Tokiaho?
He's got some toe. One major plus point actually for England in all of the rubble, might be a bit strong, but let's go with it, is the scrum. The scrum, which had been identified as a major area of weakness, but actually was cracking on Saturday in Dublin against one of the best front rows in the world. And it seems like Ellis Genge has got the wool on Ty Furlong a little bit, because with 14 men last year at Twickenham, Genge got the better of Furlong, and he did again on Saturday, and props to Richard Cockerell.
I was just going to say, watching on TV, that battle in particular was really interesting, because the first one you thought, oh, I wonder if that's a bit 50-50. But then the second one came and you thought, whatever Genge is doing here, Yakka Paper's buying it.
And that's the key, right, isn't it? That's what England said before. England said this before the tournament. It said that we've been below our best scrummaging-wise, but actually now the real damaging thing is that we have got this reputation as a side that goes down under pressure and concedes penalties under pressure and just lapses in the fight, as they did in the autumn. So, you've got to sift through a bit of rubble, maybe.
Yeah.
Certainly more so, more rubble than might have been ideal given the France result. But I do think that they've certainly got something to kind of to build on into the World Cup summer.
Next thing we need to talk about is the red card. Brian Moore's done a column on the Telegraph Rugby website this morning, which says that...
Don't hate the player, hate the game.
Frustration needs to go towards the law, not the referees, exactly. Yeah, these are the laws that have been established. The law was followed by Jakob Paper going through the framework, and that was how he arrived at his decision. Charles, you're looking at me with a mild grimace. Let's chat about it. Can you see why Paper got to that point? But equally, do you think it was a bit mad?
Yes. I think that World Rugby here need to come out, and I know they don't like adjudicating individual decisions, but I think it would be very, very helpful for everybody if they came out and said what the correct decision here was. Was Piper right? Did he apply the framework correctly, or didn't he? Because that's the crux here. And at the minute, the silence is deafening in a sense, because Jaco Piper's being held out, sort of hung out to dry a bit. You have to say that as rugby fans, nobody wants to see that as a red card. I think that is a fundamental truth, that nobody wants to see that as a red card. Yes, we have to protect players, and that a lot of players are getting concussion, and there's a lot of lawsuits knocking about now regarding the game, and there could be a lot of money paid out, and that needs to change. But if you're giving that as a red card, then I don't see how the sport can continue into these circumstances, because that was completely accidental. Freddie Stewart had a millisecond to react. There'd been a knock-on, which changes everything. And also, if you are just going back to Jaco Piper, in terms of the framework, he said absolutely no mitigation. I mean, I actually thought that Hugo Keenan did drop. I did think there was a dip, actually, yeah. A late dip from Hugo Keenan, which, considering the fact that Jaco Piper should have used contextual judgment to note that this was completely accidental and that Freddie Stewart was not turning his shoulder to shoulder charge someone, as the suggestion and insinuation was. Given all those facts, when you add in the knock-on, when you add in the slight Hugo Keenan drop, I think all of those things can add up to quite a strong mitigation. It doesn't necessarily need to be one thing that mitigates. You know, you can have several different areas that all add up to mitigation. And I think even a yellow card would have been harsh.
Just to add to that, I think there's often this argument about slow motion replays, isn't there? And actually, we shouldn't necessarily have multiple angles and repeats of slow-mo replays of incidents like that, because it can cloud your judgment in one way or another. I can't remember from at the time whether an actual live sort of replay was shown to Jaco Paper when the incident was being reviewed sort of in real time.
I remember Luke Pearce doing it a couple of times. Because, saying, can I see that in real time?
Because I think actually if you view it in real time, you do appreciate more that it is purely clumsiness at worst, really, from Stewart. Slow motion, sure, you can tick all the boxes and yeah, get to a red card absolutely, quite easily. I can
but
see,
you could probably do that a million times
again.
See
how he did that. So I wonder, this argument about should we be reviewing things in live as well as slow-mo, I think that's actually a really strong example of something they need to think about. Because I don't think you give the red card if you look at it in real time.
No, and they also made that decision very quickly. I thought they came to that decision very quickly. Marius Jonker, the TMO, was very quick to come in and say there are no more angles. And then it seemed like his mind had been made up that quickly. And Nigel Owens wrote about this in The Telegraph a few weeks ago, about how speed of decisions is all well and good, but you can't sacrifice accuracy for that. And I feel like less use of the TMO is what we need to strive for, but make sure that it is for the key decisions and you take your time over those key decisions. For instance, in that first half, Jaco Piper reviewed a potential knock-on crossing penalty scrum,
which had been called in either by the touch judge or by...
Which had been called in from an Irish box kick, a potential blocking line from Anthony Watson. We had to go upstairs to review it. That is not something that we should be going upstairs for. A marginal blocking call.
Less than delighted with that.
Quite. And that's... So what I would say is there, take that out, play on there, and spend the time that it took to review that call looking further at the steward, at the potentially game-changing, Grand Slam-defining, potentially, incident that happened at the end of the first half, and make sure you get that call right. Because I think as a, whatever the laws are, whatever the framework is, I think as rugby fans and as a sport, no one wants to see that as a red card. Even people who are completely on board with sending people off for accidental collisions to the head. I mean, we've been told that if it has to be foul play, that's the first marker, that's the first indicator for a red card is, was there foul play? And if there wasn't foul play, it's not even a penalty. So once you start at that, was there foul play from Freddie Stewart there? Being honest, I think as trying to be as impartial as we can, I would say no, there was not foul play there because it was completely inadvertent. There were so many mitigating factors and it happened so quickly that I would say there's not foul play, which means it's not even a penalty. I can it looked ugly and it looked worse in slow motion, and it's a shame that Hugo Keenan had to go off for a HIA and might have, you know, suffered a head injury, but these things might happen accidentally in rugby matches, and we need to get to grips with that, I think.
I want to make three really quick points. So the first one was that, so Piper said in the current climate, and so the kind of landscape...
Always makes me think of weather.
Yeah, but he made this point. And to be fair, Scully and I, as soon as it happened, and as soon as it happened, Freddie Stewart went, oh, as in put his hands out and towards Keenan going, oh my God, I've hurt him. Minsko said he's in trouble. They're going to go as soon as they go to the replay, and as soon as it is determined as foul play, it felt like a red card. Second point was that bizarrely, as Stewart was going off, he sort of said, "I can't put my body in any other place." And Piper went, "Well, you can sort of." And then this is terrible podcasting, but he sort of moved his shoulder and said, "You can sort of." Not do that.
Yeah. It's really unfortunate that this is a Yaka paper incident involving an elbow after the 2019 yes. World Cup. The elbow image in all the Wales fans. Sorry, Charlie, any fun?
And then the final point was that the only thing I can really remember that it reminded me of the most was actually, ironically, an incident involving Steve Borthwick and Kevin Sinfield's Leicester Tigers, which is the Guy Porter sending off against Clermont last season when he's pressed out of the line, not looking at Fritz Lee at all, and the pass has sort of gone over both of them, and all the time he's looking at the ball, and there's been a head clash. Fritz Lee, blood all over his face, has gone off for a HIA. Porter got sent off, I believe, but he also got a 3-2 ban. So after the, and I remember the press conferences in the week, sort of asking Steve Borthwick, saying, "You're going to contend this, aren't you? Because it's not a tackle; it's just a." And he did actually exactly what he did at the weekend, which is sort of go. That we're not going to comment on it until the disciplinary process has played out, which is happening tomorrow night, Tuesday night.
Yeah, I was going to say, just a final note on it, Freddie Stewart's hearing will be in the next couple of days.
Fascinating.
Look out on the website to see what happens there. Let's finish the section by finishing on Ireland and a bit of praise. Charlie, you wrote a piece yesterday about Johnny Sexton and saying that he's probably the best Ireland player in the Six Nations era. Do you want to talk about that? What did you sort of see from him that cemented that?
I think this has got to be the greatest Ireland team of all time, hasn't it? Regardless of how they go at the World Cup, I just think that series win in New Zealand is huge. I think the manner of this Grand Slam and how they've built up to it, again, super impressive. And I think he is the greatest on-field influence on that greatest team. And I just think how he governs momentum swings in games is and how all of that experience adds up, and he's just so sharp, and actually he carried the fight to England a bit while those around, if a couple of his touch finders were a bit oddly kind of shaky.
Will Greenwood writing for us said that he had a 50p pence in the first half because he kept shanking them and was all over the place.
Apart from that, the inside, really clever inside ball across the face of Omani to Van der Fleer, which needed an awesome tackle from Willis, and then really good scramble defence on the edge. That led to the quick tap penalty, and he saw his
name up in lights there, didn't he?
Yeah, he did. But when he did it and when he got held up, I thought that's a little bit muddled, that decision. But he was really kind of really pushing the envelope for Ireland. But then when it really came down to it, and as I say, with England 10-9 behind, looking like they were growing, although clearly shattered, that kick just over the top of Marchant, who'd just come on for Arundel, causing Watson to get back, and then three chasers bundle him over the try line. That's what I'm talking about governing momentum swings, and that's where he's just been so impressive over the last... Well, I think even in this mini World Cup period, because this World Cup cycle, sorry, because he personifies how Ireland have pushed through a tricky period with wanting to expand their phase play, you know, getting absolutely pumped by England a couple of times in 2020, but sticking with it. And that's what's got them to this point.
He's like a fine wine, isn't he? He's like Tom Brady in his 30s and 40s, just seems to get better. Charles, the debate about whether he's the great, we were sort of chatting yesterday about whether he was the greatest Irish player ever. Now that's a trickier debate, because you have got Willie John McBride, you've got Mike Gibson, you've got Fergus Slattery, you've got Brian O'Driscoll, Paul O'Connell. I don't know. That, I find that quite hard to sort of determine, but do you certainly think he's in the conversation?
Definitely, just through pure, you know, sort of achievements and trophies won, and also what he's achieved at the club game as well, you know, with Leinster, which has been part of a phenomenal golden era for Leinster. So, yeah, I mean, I wouldn't be arguing against Johnny Sexton being probably top five Ireland players of all time, and certainly I think anybody could put forward a good case for him being number one.
Lovely stuff. Right, a couple of other games on, sorry Charles, not Super Saturday, just bog standard,
yeah, bog
Saturday.
Standard Saturday.
So let's touch on them next. Okay, two other games. The game before Ireland-England was in Paris, and Charles Richardson, you were there. So let's hear about France against Wales. You certainly got to see some fun attacking rugby, put it that way.
Yeah, loads of tries. I mean, Wales scored four of them. And they did look improved. I think there was a little bit of the mentality with them that they'd, a bit of an English mentality, or certainly a similar mentality to what England had, in that it was almost backs against the wall, nothing to lose, really. A bit like England going to Dublin. Nobody's expecting us to win, so we might as well go and, you know, just lay it all on the line, give it a good shot. And Wales started the better of the two teams. They know that France love to start matches quickly, really well, get points on the board early. And they did. They did thwart that, and Wales scored the first try. Gorgeous Reese Webb pass, actually, into the midfield that cut out the entire French midfield, and North went under the sticks. At no point, even with them 7-0 up, did I ever think we're going to be seeing an upset here. And actually, as soon as France scored, well, I think Ramos kicked a penalty, and then France scored that fantastic Penno try. And all of a sudden, after a fantastic Welsh 15 minutes, they were behind on the scoreboard. And it was sort of like, yeah, I think their goose is cooked after 15 minutes. But that doesn't take away from the fact that it was the best Welsh sort of spell, 15-20 minute spell of the tournament, I think.
Such a kind of wild tournament for Wales. I've written up some Six Nations awards, which should be on the website today, Monday, at some point. And Russ Petty tweeted out that Wales in the tournament made 26 changes to their selection, which over the course of five games is unsustainable, I guess, in the short term. But obviously the whole concept for Warren Gatland over this last 5 weeks, I think, has just been, over five games, sorry, has just been to see what he has for the World Cup. And did he have a quote afterwards about something like, teams will underestimate us going into the World Cup, or teams won't expect much from us?
We're going to surprise a few, is what he thought. I mean, I'm not sure. I don't know. I mean, they've got a lot of work to do. It's weird as well. Sorry, Joe. It's weird that six of that starting pack in Paris on Saturday, six of the eight started that World Cup semi-final loss against South Africa. So that shows, you know, where they've come from. And that was a Gatland side, where they've come from with the side that Gatland built, and where they've developed to 4 years on. Six of that pack is the same.
Just on that, he said in the build-up to the game, it was sort of hinted that, you know, this might be the last hurrah for some of the players selected. Watching the game, did any sort of spring to mind where you thought, oh, I'm not sure he'll be at the World Cup, or do you think they'll all be there? Do you reckon it was a bluff? What do you think?
I think certainly it was the last Six Nations for a few of them. In terms of the ones that featured in Paris, they're surely all going to be there or thereabouts. The big decision is whether he chooses to move on from the likes of Alan Wynne-Jones, that sort of thing. Are they now over the hill? That's the big decision. I mean, to be honest, I think that for all of Dan Biggar's strengths, I think that Owen Williams has potentially emerged as the sort of preeminent fly half at the minute for Wales. And I think Dan Biggar will be in the World Cup squad, but I think they should be going into it like sort of, you know, hanging their hat on Owen Williams at fly half and letting him, you know, and sort of unlock, try and unlock some defences. Because against England, he looked composed, he looked
like he was bringing a good sort of level of structure and organisation to the Welsh attack. And actually, it was something that Biggar didn't really bring on Saturday. For all of Wales's attacking strengths, it was more because they tried to come out the blocks and play really quickly and sort of move France around, which is very easy to do. But I didn't think that for a second that the sort of, you know, it felt a bit haphazard. Sure. At the start, it was impressive and it was quick, it was swift, but you always felt like it was that level of speed was unsustainable, and at some point some control was required, and where was it coming from?
Such a mad few years that Owen Williams has had. He went to Japan for a bit, he went to Worcester, he's gone to the Ospreys and played really well, and now he seems to have emerged as the starting fly half ahead of Biggar, which just shows, you know, rugby's weird. Careers can suddenly turn around if you've got the talent.
And the irony, of course, is that when he was at Leicester, he was probably the best Welsh fly half playing in the UK. He was starting in a very good Leicester team that was getting to knock out stages of the Premiership and of Europe. And there was a lot of call in the Welsh media for him to be starting at fly half, and then never really did. I mean, I think he had a couple of runouts at 12 at that point. But yeah, made his first start at fly half in this year's Six Nations, which seems crazy.
Good Six Nations for a few ex-Worcester players.
Yeah.
Duane van der Merwe, Ollie Lawrence, Owen Williams.
Yeah,
fair play, because they're coming into that tournament off the back of just the oddest year.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely wild. Charles, when DuPont threw that pass for Penno, I know you said it was your highlight. What are we talking? Hats in the air from the crowd, baguettes flying in celebration.
Yeah,
it was pretty great. And DuPont had a great tournament, but that might be my favourite moment.
Yeah, it was a standing ovation. And I mean, so that pass was fired directly towards the press box. Obviously, we were on halfway, so we were on halfway, and obviously this was in the 22, but it was that direction it was coming towards us. And actually, when he flung it, I was like, well, it's almost a bit of a pass to nothing, really, because he just needs to get it somewhere. He just needs to put enough enough hang time and air time on it that whereby Penno can judge it and go and attack it. But with the flight of it, I thought he just lobbed it straight into touch because it went so high to start with and it had such a loop on it that I thought, oh my God, he's just flung it straight into touch. And he didn't. It dropped beautifully straight into the path of Penno, and it was an absolute... And that came off the back of a gorgeous Umtomac fade left Tompkins for dead. Tompkins was actually somebody who I think should be starting at 12 for Wales and had some really good moments in Paris. But then a couple of times as well, he was mugged off by Untermag and completely manhandled by Jonathan Donty early on, where he just ripped his skin off, really. Hit him so hard that, it was just one of the biggest hits I've seen in a long time.
Mortal combat.
Yeah, 12 on 12, sort of big 12 on slightly smaller 12 who... who's a physical player, Tompkins, but Donty manhandled him. But he was good, but then Untermac just ghosted him. DuPont had this cunning decoy run in and out, left Wales defence for dead. Great offload from Untermac, and then that DuPont pass. Yeah, it was phenomenal. It was a sensational try.
Saw the fireworks going off at full time. That was your second Stade de France trip of this Six Nations?
Yeah.
I feel like we're going to have a very fun World Cup, is that fair to say, based on everything you've seen over the last few months?
I think that's very fair to say, unless France get knocked out in the group stages, which I know is immensely unlikely, but I think the dummies will be spat out if that happens, and they will shut up. I mean, the French are famous for doing that anyway. I remember speaking to Michel Roux Jr. when I interviewed him last year ahead of Le Crunch. He went to watch Harlequins play Toulouse, and he was supposed to be hosting a post-match function in the stadium, and Harlequins won, and it was cancelled. And the same on Saturday.
So will there be knockout stages?
It would be very French for them not to be. And the same on Saturday, actually, because obviously if Wales had won that game, there would not have been a firework display. And also, what is also quite funny is if Wales had won on Saturday, there was going to be no post-match media from France whatsoever.
Speaking of fireworks, I got absolutely done in Dublin. Very louder than I can remember.
Oh, yeah.
Had a game before and just wasn't expecting it. And
just before kickoff,
yeah,
yeah, it got me as well. Goodness. Ireland v France. It's like a gun. It's like four gunshots, isn't it?
It was like a gunshot. And fortunately, I was sat down, and Will Keller, our colleague from the Times, was standing up. So that, I mean, obviously that accentuates your shock. And he was just as shocked as me, I think. But
you've got to be careful up there. You're very high. If you
really
lose
high.
If you lose your balance, really all of a sudden you're tumbling.
It's steep at the Aviva.
Let's also touch on Scotland against Italy. I think, Charles, you mentioned earlier, this was a fairly underwhelming Scottish performance. And does that actually make it more frustrating that Italy couldn't produce a I mean, Italy just haven't won, which seems weird because we've been praising them so highly. And actually, they had a better points difference than Wales, I just checked. And they've produced so much great rugby this tournament, and yet they're without a win.
So much good stuff from Italy. So much. They seem to have improved at the areas that they were bad at before, and then sort of taken their foot off the pedal at the areas they were good at. There's so much good, cohesive teamwork and attacking fluidity and shape and all those things that we're not used to seeing in an Italian side. And then sloppy individual errors let it undo all of that work. And that's what happened against Scotland. That's sort of what happened against Wales as well. I don't know if it's better application, better attention to detail. I don't know if it's a lack of sort of fitness. And obviously, you know, when you're not fit enough, that's when these sloppy errors creep in. The scrum as well. It's unlike an Italian side to be dominated at the scrum, but they were demolished really by the Scottish scrum on Saturday, which is a worry for them because. Obviously, they're in the pool with France and New Zealand.
Well, I was just going to say, just to finish off, I mean, I don't want to take the air out of what's been, I think a really positive tournament for Kieran Crowley and his squad. But realistically, do we expect that Italy are going to challenge France or New Zealand in pool A of the World Cup and cause them too many issues to worry about progressing? My feel is maybe it's a bit early. Charlie, what do you think?
I think it's a bit early, but I think if they put up some sort of fight in those games, and as I keep saying ad nauseum, probably, sorry about this, about them, if they stay true to the style that they've shown and they keep getting better at that, so they have something to hang their hat on, I think it can still be a positive tournament, because I agree, Colsey, I think it's been a really positive. And poor Garbizzi Jr. With penalty advantage, so I understand why he did stretch, but just coughing that up would have been just such a cool moment.
I think the caveat for Italy as well that we should mention is, yes, okay, they did fall narrowly short against Scotland and they weren't great. However, they were missing their two sort of most dangerous, most cutting backs with the most cutting edge, Tommaso Menoncello and Ange Cavazzo. And they look like big losses. Other teams have greater depth than Italy. And I think with Italy, if they're going to trouble New Zealand or France, they have to be full strength starting 15, certainly.
Capuazzo is a really interesting one, isn't it? Because he's clearly such an intriguing, exciting player that he gets hyped up. But actually, his importance is really quite significant, because they do create a lot and they do stretch sides on the edges. And when you've got the additional threat of him ghosting into lines and, you know, making two-on-twos into two-on-ones by burning someone on the outside, then or getting on the end of these breaks because he's just so quick, it makes a big difference. It really does. One of my abiding memories of the Six Nations, I think, will be watching him live at Twickenham. It was just very cool.
Come on, Italy, prove us wrong at the World Cup. Cause a shock would certainly make things interesting. Okay, next we're gonna just reflect on what England have learned from this tournament, really, and what they're gonna take forward into the World Cup. Okay, Steve Borthwick's first campaign, and he won two games, and England finished fourth. I mean, it wasn't a huge improvement from the Eddie Jones era, but then again, he was given a bit of a tricky task, sort of coming in late and trying to completely revamp a squad who looked as though they'd lost a bit of direction. So, I don't know, Charlie, if you were giving this team a quick grade, if you had to sort of assess their tournament as a whole, what would you give them?
C?
I was thinking C plus.
I was thinking C plus as well. Sorry.
I just think the manner of that loss to France skews everything, because it was so startlingly bad and so and just weird in retrospect, because what you expect from a Steve Borthwick team is incremental gains, and it was just a huge step backwards. And then actually, if you'd have thought the trajectory of how they went from Ireland to Wales, when, as I keep saying with the two wickets analogy, I think their performance was better than the score suggested in Cardiff. And if you their trajectory in that game seemed to suggest that they would run France close and then produce something like they did against Ireland when they troubled the best team in the world. So that just weird trough in the middle is when they had 2 weeks building up to it, it was really strange. Now, the one thing I can think of, the more obvious thing without knowing kind of anything that's going on behind the scenes, is that sometimes we hear retrospectively that coaches have really flogged players in the conditioning side of things. I think England did that in 2018 when they had a really poor Six Nations. Eddie Jones just felt as though they needed the block of fitness, and that potentially it would be a case of the players having to defy that fatigue in games, and you know, and where the results went, so be it. That can be the only thing I can really think of for sort of an excuse over you know, if we take the Smith selection stuff as a kind of separate, but I think, yeah, to recover from that and to lay some foundations, they, as I say, they do have to build on those foundations very quickly ahead of the World Cup, but I think they will with the coaches that are coming in, and the fact that it's going to be Steve Borthwick's kind of it will feel really like Steve Borthwick's team, with the additions of Wigglesworth and especially Alan Walters, so yeah, that, I feel like maybe the tiniest step forward, but sort of with a kind of more hopeful outlook.
The first half in Dublin and how well they played actually made me more frustrated with the France performance.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
More puzzled.
The total lack of application at Twickenham a week before versus the determination and grit that they showed. I was actually quite annoyed. Because it just, you know, you shouldn't be that. They shouldn't have been as bad as they were. Like, it just wasn't acceptable, was it? Charles, no. give me some positives, Charles. Give me reasons to feel good about England. Maybe Manu Tuilagi's return. I meant to talk about this in the earlier section, but he was quite handy.
Yeah, he was handy. He was solid. He's not the same beast of old, is he?
No.
He's really not. There was a moment in that first half, you know, we were chatting about it beforehand, where he ran one-on-one into Caelan Doris and he lost that collision. Now, I mean, the Manu Tuilagi of old could have run head-on-head into anybody and not lost the collision.
Hopefully not head-on-head in the current climate.
No, though, otherwise Jaco Pieper had been straight on the phone to Marius Jonker.
Yes, exactly.
And
he would have agreed with the facts. So,
yeah.
Death knell.
Yeah.
I agree with the facts. Terror.
Yeah, I agree with the facts. That is, I mean, what does that even mean? Surely if it's facts, it doesn't need agreeing with, does it? If it's facts, it's facts, isn't it?
It's
not objective.
On a tangent right now. Yeah. Come back to Manu. Talk to me about Manu.
Yeah, Manu. Positives. Scrum. Scrum was a positive, I think, especially on the improvements, especially as it was ranked, Steve Borthwick told us, ranked as the worst scrum in Tier 1 nations. I don't think it is now. And also, replacements come on, McAvin and Polo and Dan Cole, you don't lose anything there. And also, I think that first half in Dublin, as you've touched on, Colsey, is a massive positive, because I think they have proved that they can do it, and that what Kevin Sinfield defensively is trying to implement is doable, is achievable, and works, because they had Ireland rattled, they had them on the back foot. It was a cute inside pass. That was the only time that they were, that their try line was breached and that they were properly unlocked in that first half. Other positives, Freddie Stewart's performance at 15. Not including Saturday, where he only had managed 40 minutes, but he's made that shirt his own. Ollie Chesham, and what a sort of heartbreaking news last week that he's now touch and go for the World Cup with an ankle injury. The back row, other than the French game, had very good moments. I was surprised to see that Jack Willis, actually, despite all of these sort of wild tackling statistics in the individual matches, he's not in like the sort of even the top 10 tackles made in the tournament as a whole, which means he must have had a very quiet game against France in terms of tackles made, probably even quieter than I expected.
I'd have to look it up, but yeah, I think that's right.
Missed a game, didn't he?
He did miss a game, but so did the top tackler of the entire tournament is Matt Ferguson, and he was on the bench on Saturday.
Yeah. Willis with 20 tackles in the first half and two in the second half, obviously because of his yellow card.
Yeah,
because he was off the field for a bit.
Again, actually, many people, which we haven't touched on yet, many people think that was more of a red than the Stewart's, and actually a lot of Irish fans have said that as well, haven't they?
Charlie, you helpfully have written on the website 3 signs England are heading in the right direction. So can you tell me what the 3 signs are that England had?
They're the ones that, there are a few of the ones that Charles has mentioned there. The set piece,
A little bit of the directness of their attack. They have, I just think, to have that, whether it was Ollie Lawrence or Manu Tuilagi, they have that threat there. Just to touch on Manu Tuilagi's performance, I actually thought defensively he was pretty strong.
Yeah.
A couple of those. Tug Furlong yeah. wasn't a factor, because a lot of the time, at least twice, maybe three times, Tuilagi was sort of pressurizing him and causing those really devastating passes that Furlong can throw to kind of be misdirected.
I think Henshaw went by him in the first half, didn't he?
Maybe, yeah. I mean, Henshaw's gun. Awesome.
Yeah.
But Arundel got back. So this was the thing. Yeah, a real tangent here, but Arundel's performance, I know he did a bit of an Ollie Hassel Collins, didn't he? That really reminded me of that same moment where there was in my press seat going, just go on.
yeah, but in your head you're going, nobody in the coaching staff wants you to run this back.
Yeah, so just bear that in mind. But Keenan lassoed him, and Porter was over to win. He had that moment, and then Matt Hansen and I think Henshaw got across, and there's two turnovers with two runs, but the nuts and bolts of it, won a Jackal turnover, didn't he? He's quick enough to pressurise in those kicking exchanges. And actually, one point that I remember people making about Lewis Roux-Samet when he came on the scene was that at this stage of his career, he might make wrong defensive reads, but he's actually so quick over the ground that he can almost recover.
Yeah.
And that's really cool, because what is happening is that you're not costing your team that much necessarily, because you're recovering to make any given tackle, but also that you're learning and going, oh, geez, yeah, okay, that's the right decision to make next time. What did you ask me, Colsey? Oh, the areas to get better. So in two games against Wales and Ireland, they've kicked on their own terms, done it a lot better. Against France, they didn't kick on their own terms because they were a bit frantic and because France went hard at the breakdown. So they now have, that is how the kicking is unavoidable. It's such an important part. Ireland kicked loads when they, in their best performance against France. So England are going to have to do it. And they're going to have to do it in the manner that they did against Ireland and against Wales. And then the other area was so set piece attack, kicking on their own terms, and just the multi-faceted nature of that defensive performance. So good decisions in phase play generally, really good scramble when they had to, and just being aware most of the time to those set piece plans that Ireland had and were always going to have. They're always going to have a strike or two up their sleeves.
I'm not even going to check the article, because I'm sure that you're
please subscribe. Correct. Please subscribe, and it's more than that. We get below the pay fade. So
The reason I didn't respond was because I was looking at the World Cup bracket and I was trying to work out how soon Ireland could potentially play France, and you could get them in, because that was my next question, because I'm going to ask you to pick a favourite for the World Cup. So you've got 30 seconds to think about it while I explain that. So Ireland and France could meet because you get the winner of Pool B against the runner-up of Pool A in the quarterfinals and vice versa. So unless they both win their groups, you're potentially not getting Ireland-France until the final. So Charles, Ireland or France for the World Cup? Who's your favourite?
Well, on the basis that Ireland aren't getting out the pool, I'll go France.
Are they actually not?
That's a joke for our listeners across the Irish Sea, if we have any.
It's
not anymore. Yeah. No, I will go France, because I think they've built, they've developed, they've got better. I think they have better individuals than Ireland, and I know it's not about the individual, but sometimes in those knockout matches, just that little extra individual brilliance can be what swings it. France, with a home World Cup, they've only lost at home once under Galtier, I think, and that was to Scotland in that 2021.
Don't say Scotland with that turn of voice. Come on.
Sorry, you've done me that. I didn't mean to. That was subconscious. Okay. It was actually, they lost to a very good Scottish performance, is what we should say. And that is genuinely what I believe. I think France is favourites, just.
Hi, Charlie.
South Africa.
Oh, what?
Yeah, I think France over Ireland, I think South Africa over them both. I was just watching the game on Saturday, thinking that South Africa will be looking. I know Ireland had a few guys out, but I just thought that they will really be licking their lips at the mall gains they can make, and how much that their hyper-aggressive line speed can maybe scramble that Irish phase play. In the game in November in Dublin was brutal, wasn't it? And actually, if Ireland had pushed a couple more passes and managed to beat that blitz a couple of times, then they could have been more comfortable than they were, which was reasonably comfortable until the last 5 minutes in that game. But I just think that at a neutral venue, that pool game is going to go towards South Africa. And how funny would it be if someone won from the other side of the draw?
Well, I was just going to say
those guys punching each other out, and then. But I think whoever gets through that quarterfinal from the tough side of the draw, will have a lot of confidence. And then, I mean, unless there are improvements on the other side, on the other side of the draw, then it's going to be. We're looking at a France-Ireland final.
Yeah, yeah, it can be. I mean, we've said it before that the draw is so stupid, but the fact that you can win a group if you're Ireland, and then what, your reward is facing one of New Zealand or France, or Italy. Sorry, Charles.
Yeah, Georgia-Italy final.
I mean, I just find that absolutely madness. It's not very fair if you're number one side in the world and that's the draw you get. For what it's worth, I just love the idea of France winning a World Cup at home. I just think it's really... It'd just be great.
It would be great if it was one of those two. A Northern Hemisphere winner would be really cool for the sport in these parts.
I think it would be good. I think it would be very good indeed. Right, after an excellent men's Six Nations tournament, we're now going to chat to Fiona Thomas about the women's Six Nations tournament, which gets underway this weekend. Can we just start with England? Do you think there's a couple of key injuries in the squad? How are they sort of shaping up ahead of trying to defend their title?
Straight off the back of a World Cup, you always feel that, you know, these sorts of championships take on a bit of a different meaning. And certainly, I think it'll be a sort of transitional campaign for a lot of teams, England included. So, in terms of the Red Roses squads, it's very, very different to, this time last year when they were, you know, getting all things prepped for that tournament in New Zealand. There's been a few key injuries to a lot of experienced names. Emily Scarrett, we don't think will feature. Zoe Harrison, their fly half, who was one of the Red Roses' standout players, to be honest, at the World Cup last year. And unfortunately, she's done her ACL. So it's going to be really interesting to see how kind of, you know, they go this campaign without these sorts of big names. Abby Ward, another standout forward who was, you know, so dominant for England in the line-out, has been a mainstay of that side for so long. She's obviously announced her pregnancy, which is super exciting. Lots of you know, changes, but we've got a raft of new faces within the team as well. And one I think worth keeping an eye on is May Campbell, Saracens hooker. I think she'd been capped at under England under 20 level quite a few years ago, but she's always sort of shone for Saracens in the Premier 15. So got a totally different feel, to be honest, compared to this time last year.
I was going to ask you about new faces, so that works quite well. Sort of a familiar face back in the squad is Mo Hunt, after she was left out of the World Cup squad. Can I just ask about, and that was quite a controversial sort of talking point at the time, given how she'd been playing and what she contributed. Why is she now back in, do you think? Is it just purely down to outstanding form?
Oh, literally, Ben. Like, she has been on fire for Gloucester Heartbreak in the Premier 15s this season. The girl has not stopped. You know, ever since getting that sort of shock, I guess, that shock to say that she wasn't going to be in that World Cup squad last year, she's spoken about how much that hurt. And within 48 hours of receiving that news, she was literally back out on a rugby pitch, you know, playing for her club. She's a woman who wears a heart on her sleeve, and she literally just threw herself back into it. And she has sort of spearheaded Gloucester Heartbreak's title charge for this season. She's, without a shadow of a doubt, the most informed nine in the Prem 15s at the minute. And I will be certainly surprised if she does not kind of get that starting shirt.
It's the final Women's Six Nations for two kind of pivotal figures, really. Simon Middleton as the coach and Sarah Hunter getting a very deserved farewell in Newcastle for the first game. Just a word on those two, and I guess try to sum up how much they've contributed to the England women's team.
Where to start? I mean, Sarah Hunter, wow, what a player, what an ambassador for the sport. She has, you know, literally been the figurehead of the English women's game for so long now. And to it's what she deserves, really, to bow out at Newcastle, her home stadium. You know, the script couldn't have been written better for her, really. I think when she looks back on her career, you know, it will be a bit tinged with disappointment for those two back-to-back World Cup final defeats. But let's not forget that she's led her country for fantastically during the time that she has worn that captaincy armband. And let's not forget she's a World Cup winner as well. You know, she was part of that 2014 squad. I remember when I was out at the World Cup last year, Simon Middleton did sort of, you know, he was heaping praise on her for when she became England's most capped player. And he said this kind of stunning line whereby he said, you know, he had never seen Sarah Hunter train poorly. You know, there are some players who rock up and might not give 100% in the training session or might have an off day, but Sarah, he said, always gave or gives 100%. And I think that's what we'll remember when it comes to Sarah Hunter. As for Simon Middleton himself, yeah, you know, he's been at the helm of that English women's team now for nearly a decade. You know, he has overseen some extraordinary change. You know, if you think about from going right the way back to kind of when the women's testing was pretty very amateur, moving into semi-professionalism, and now obviously kind of, if you're England, you know, well into professionalism. He's been pivotal in you know, wanting to push the game on, to recognise where the women's game needs to go. And he was a very influential figure in pushing the Rugby Football Union to make those full-time contracts. Is it lenient that he's in charge for another championship, given what's happened in the context of the last two World Cup cycles? Maybe. Would you see that happen in the men's game? Definitely not. But, you know, not taking anything away from what he's achieved in charge of the Red Roses. And it's great that he also gets that send-off as well come April the 29th, when England welcome France in the what could be a historic occasion at Twickenham. First standalone Women's Six Nations fixture at the home of English rugby. And I think we could well be on to another crowd record. I think the latest figure was like 36,000 tickets have been sold for that one. So that should be good.
Feels like it's in a really interesting position, given that England have won 5 out of the last 6, I think it is, in the last 4 in a row. But combined with Middleton leaving, combined, like you said, with the injuries to Zoe Harrison and Emily Scarrett and whether Scarrett's going to be available, this idea that you're trying to rebuild a squad, but you're bringing back Mae Hunt, who you didn't pick. Who do you think realistically, I guess two parts to this question, would it actually be good for the tournament to have a different winner just to kind of, you know, build up competitiveness and just, I don't know, make it more of a potentially interesting competition? And also, secondly, who are the biggest challenges, do you think, who are going to potentially push England and potentially take the title?
Great question. I mean, you know, we all want a competitive Women's Six Nations. That is ultimately the issue, which is holding the championship back. You know, we've just come off the back of a great, enthralling Men's Six Nations where, you know, you couldn't call some of those games, you know, the way Italy pushed France. And, you know, you want that in the Women's Championship. You don't want to see, you know, lopsided scorelines week in, week out. And I think it has sort of, it's not the elephant in the room because everyone knows that it's not a competitive championship yet. I might have spoken too soon, you know, given the change that we've seen across a lot of the squads, you know, this season, you know, we could be in for a kind of completely different ball game. So maybe that will come back to haunt me. I don't know. But yeah, like, you know, it's all a circle, isn't it, in women's sport? If you have a competitive product, and I hate using that word when it comes to describe sport, but, you know, that's when you attract sponsors and partners who want to be involved in, you know, promoting, you know, the game. In terms of England's greatest challenges, I mean, France always lurking, aren't they? But, you know, they're a side who've gone through, like, immense change as well since the World Cup. So, you know, you've got Jessie Tremoulier, former World Player of the Year, retired. Laurie Sansous, a.k.a. also known as the mini DuPont of women's game, last year's Player of the Championship. She's also retired as well. They've got a new captain in Audrey Fellaini. Great story. She wasn't even in France's World Cup squad last year, and now she's suddenly the captain.
So Fiona, if you have to pick a winner, who do you feel is the most likely team?
You've just got to go for England, haven't you? They're number one in the world still for a reason. They're World Cup finalists for a reason. They will be so determined to bounce back from that World Cup final defeat and to sort of, you know, restore that sort of normality, if you like. So yeah, I'm going to go for the Red Roses.
Very good. It all gets underway this weekend. We'd highly recommend Fiona's interview with Lydia Thompson, which was on the Telegraph website recently as well, to a bit of essential reading before it gets underway. Fiona, thanks for your time.
Cheers, Ben. See ya.
Let's jump now to some of your readers' questions. Thank you all for sending in your questions, not just for this episode, actually, but throughout the whole Six Nations. They've been really nice to sort of hear from you and get your opinions. And we're going to start with a question this week from our colleague at the Daily Mail, Alex Bywater, who says, is Charlie wearing that jumper again? Charlie, what jumper are you wearing?
Got a WhatsApp message from Alex querying the jumper, which is a bit sad. No, but I've gone from yellow to green. Okay. Thanks, Alex. Yeah, you'll be able to see it.
It's now sort of a toothpaste number, would you say? I mean, yeah. So I'm just trying to think. It's sort of a nice polo.
Peppermint.
I'm wearing a similar colour, and I literally put it on before I left home. And I thought,
we've both got Irish ancestry, haven't we? So maybe that's the reason.
Are we accidentally sort of celebrating Ireland's success? Yeah, that's probably it.
I'm wearing one of Rishi Sunak's finest quarter zips.
So you are. And that's on trend for this podcast.
Correct,
so that's
absolutely.
Good. On to other questions. Dickie asks, oh, this is actually good. How long until players seek dangerous contact to win penalties and force cards against
already
the opposition? It's already happening, Dickie. It's already happening.
Already happening. Not saying that Ireland were definitely doing it. I'm really not saying that. But
he's not saying
there
it so
was
much,
a little but... there was a little exchange after the Donbrat one, which was one of those ones that looks really innocuous live. But then the replay looked terrible, and it looked like a shoulder charge from Don Brandt towards the top of Sexton's neck. But Sexton went down, because it would have hurt. And Farrell was sort of chasing him round, going, sir, if he's holding his head, is he going off for a HIA? And that was, I mean, there is no place for pundits sort of, well, there almost isn't a place for pundits kind of accusing players of play acting, because it's, they put their bodies on the line in what is a super physical sport, but it certainly is already happening. And I'm fairly sure that, you know, players know that if they've been involved in a decision that could be questioned and there could be a bit larger sanctions for it, I'm sure that they're staying down to draw attention to it.
Watching on TV, just to note, I could hear Farrell a lot, and that was clearly part of the plan. And I don't think he was talking just to get a relationship with the ref. I think he was talking to try and ruffle up Ireland and unsettle them.
This is fascinating, because this whole Owen Farrell talking to refs became an issue within the England camp, because Eddie Jones mentioned it and sort of suggested that that was the main reason Courtney Laws was taking over the captaincy. Since then, and even since Owen Farrell's taken the captaincy back, he's still been a bit subdued in how he's interacted with the refs. That went out the window on Saturday. And I actually think he played a little bit better because of it. So whether you go, I don't know, whether you revisit the captaincy and just go, look, Owen Farrell's always going to be a leader, and you saw, I think, from their performance against Ireland, what they missed against France, and that is what he is, a galvanising force. He really is.
He's fired up, wasn't he?
I don't know. I don't think. Ellis Genger's got a lot better, hasn't he? He's really good at it. He's actually quite very emotionally intelligent with how he talks to referees. But I don't think he could have done any different for that steward incident.
Charles, my next question links to you. Because you've spoken a lot about the number eight position in the tournament and about Billy Vunipola and just wondering whether, you know, he should be in the mix. And the question we had from Richie is there anything to suggest that Billy Vunipola isn't the best number eight available for England after Alex Donbrandt had an underwhelming championship? I mean, I almost find this question inadvertently quite funny, because it seems like yesterday we were saying that Billy Vunipola didn't look that great and maybe they should turn to Alex Donbrandt.
Yeah.
And now we're sort of back where we started, kind of thing.
But I think that's fine, isn't it? Because we now know. You know, Alex Donbrandt has had a shot, and actually it's perfectly fine to say, okay, Billy Vunipola wasn't playing well enough as he should have been. Should Alex Donbrandt, you know, have a shot and be given a go? The answer at that point was probably yes. He's had a shot. did he look like an international standard number eight? In parts, maybe, but certainly not as a whole, and certainly not against France, and maybe not against Ireland. You know, the two best teams in the world. Should Billy Vunipola be brought back in my opinion, yes. I think that that England pack still, for all of its assiduousness, for all of its graft, for all of its tenacity, and for all of its improvements against Ireland, still lacks, I think, a big ball carrier.
Well, you're right in a way, because it's fine that we now might have a better opinion of Don Brandt, but we still don't really have an answer to what is suddenly becoming a bit of a problem position. I mean, I don't know who the number eight is to start the World Cup or who the best option is. Charlie's leaning forward. Charlie?
I can see the World Cup camp being a bit of a shootout between Zach Mercer and Tom Willis.
I'd be flabbergasted if he picks Mercer, honestly. I really would, because I just don't think that he's a Borthwick. I don't think he's a Borthwick player. I mean, I rate him, but I don't know what Mercer gives you in the tight in what England are lacking, yeah, that Don Brandt doesn't.
Well, somebody. Know. So, my contention with that would be, they might look to someone like Launchbury as one of the locks, and then because obviously, Zach Mercer's gone amazingly well in France, but he's going to be behind a pretty hefty Montpellier type five a lot of the time.
And he actually hasn't been tearing it up that much this season, right? Mercer. I mean, I don't know if that's because he knows he's going.
I think Tom Willis is more. Is more of what you're talking about, more of what you
definitely
need. He's just that, yeah, just those.
And he has been tearing it up this season, yeah, for Bordeaux, like, yeah, absolutely tearing it up. I think there is an argument, as you were saying, that maybe they might move Mario to six as well. And where does Tom Curry slot back in? If he realises that he actually doesn't have a number eight, then might he play just his three best flankers and sod the number eight, really, and just have one of your best flankers at eight and just say, we're just going to absolutely flood the breakdown, we're going to play really quickly.
Eddie was right all along.
Yeah.
Tom Curry's the number eight. I mean, I think what's interesting there is that we've talked about Mercer and Tom Willis and Launchbury, who were players who weren't involved in the Six Nations and players who aren't currently available, and I think actually that's why I've got a bit more sympathy for Steve Borthwick, because
yeah,
you're still plugging a lot of holes here in not a lot of time.
I wrote this and I had to do the England player ratings for the tournament, and I wrote this in Lewis Ludlam's entry. I thought he was clearly one of England's better performers, but just ironically, given the strength in depth or maybe just the options available to Borthwick in the back row, I think he will also be potentially, and he finished the tournament as one of the vice captains, but he could find himself in a real tight spot for certainly for the first choice 23. I think he probably now makes it to the World Cup.
Well, it's the age old thing, isn't it? It's the age old thing. Lewis Ludlam was picked to start and he played very well.
Yeah.
Is there better?
Yeah.
That's the question. Yeah, he went in and he played very, very well, but is there better? And the answer at the minute, probably, unfortunately for Lewis Ludlam, is yes.
Okay, to finish up, we're going to chat about our Six Nations player of the tournament. Lots of strong contenders from Ireland and from France, obviously. Charles, I'll come to you first. Who's your choice?
I think there's a lot of outstanding candidates, potentially more than ever, which sort of backs up our point of it being one of the best ever Six Nations. I think there are a lot of outstanding candidates across certainly two, maybe two or three teams. I'm going to go a little bit left field, and I'm going to say Thomas Ramos, the French fullback, in a position of outstanding depth across the Six Nations. You know, you look at Hugo Keenan, who is a phenomenal talent and one of the best fullbacks in the world, same as Freddie Stewart. I thought Thomas Ramos, in sort of his first stretch starting at fullback for France, looked as good as those two. He attacked beautifully. He was a second playmaker alongside Romain Antemac. It's been a problem position for France. They've experimented with Anthony Boutier and Melvin Jaminet, and now they've finally gone with Thomas Ramos. He seems to have made the shirt his own ahead of the World Cup. He came very, very close to beating Johnny Wilkinson's Six Nations record of all-time points scored in one championship this year.
Yeah, he finished on 84.
He finished on 84 points for the championship, which was miles ahead of everybody else, I think.
Yeah, the next best, I've just got it in front of me, Johnny Sexton with 35.
Right, so he's wiped the floor with everyone in points scored. That's because he scored tries and his goal kicking was nigh flawless. If he'd have grabbed a try on Saturday against Wales, it would have been, you know, squeaky bum time for Wilkinson, as they say. I was really impressed with him. Obviously, there were other outstanding candidates who were all phenomenal too, but I just thought in terms of a sort of surprise factor, an improvement, I feel like I'd happily go into bat for him.
What happened to Big Boot Boutier? Where's he gone?
Yeah, I mean, he's still playing, still knocking around, but he doesn't really get a look in now. So I know, the sort of the executor of one of the greatest ever spiral punts.
We'll always have that.
We will always have that. But yeah, he doesn't get a look in at all now. I don't think he was even in the wider 42-man squad. I might be wrong on that.
Before the age of 50-22s, that was a 22-22.
It was, yeah.
Oh, I remember it vividly.
That should have been like catching the golden snitch at Quidditch. Game over, 50 points, done.
Go home again.
Yeah, absolutely. See you later, England.
Charlie, follow that.
Follow the golden snitch. It's impossible. I had three Ireland players, and we're speaking off air about how it's probably actually more difficult to pick out an individual from this Ireland side because they're so... so multifaceted, so good at everything. I had Andrew Porter. Thought he was really good as far as carrying the fight. Conceded a few penalties here and there, but exceptional around the field. Had Hugo Keenan, boringly consistently good in the game. What might be forgotten about the England game is that, oddly enough, they didn't actually dominate the air. They were doing well despite not dominating the air, and the reason they didn't dominate the air was because Keenan was just phenomenal. But I've gone with James Ryan. He was one of a few guys that played every minute of that Grand Slam campaign, and I just feel like he's really pushed through. Talk about Mauro Itoje sort of having a bit of a plateau, fairly or unfairly, with his form. I think Ryan has pushed through that and has gone on to another level. His carrying, he had one of those loping carries against Italy, didn't he? And he had another one against Scotland. And if that offload to James Lowe had stuck, and Ireland would have had five bonus point wins out of five. Ireland are less susceptible to being bullied in the tight weather scrum or maul, and he's a big part of that. So I'm just really, really impressed by his championship.
Good choices for me to finish up. It's an obvious one, but it's Antoine Dupont. I think he is sort of. Just reminded everybody that he is the best player in the world with a sort of catalogue of amazing moments. The tackle in Dublin on Matt Hansen, the pass for Penner's try against Wales, just a masterclass against England at Twickenham where he really should have had a standing ovation from everybody. And I know he's playing behind a great pack, but I thought his control and his skill set was just extraordinary. He's different gravy. He simply is. And yeah, I think when we get to Men's World Player of the Year at the end of the year after the World Cup, I'll be very shocked if he isn't at least in the conversation.
I'd just like to quickly mention Matt Hansen, as I don't think we mentioned him in a positive frame in that conversation, and I thought he was outstanding on the wing for Ireland and really has made that shirt his own, and he's sort of, I think, up there as one of the best wings in the world, you know, and what a find.
Matt Hansen for the best post-match interview.
Absolutely.
Anyway, at least, yeah. So there's that. Right, that's it for today, and from us for the time being as well. So thanks to Charlie and Charles, as always, and a big thanks to Fiona Thomas too. You can keep up with her work during the Women's Six Nations over the next few weeks. A massive thank you to everybody who has listened and supported the podcast throughout the Six Nations as well. We've really appreciated it. Charlie's given me a bow to my left. As always, there will be comprehensive coverage over on the Telegraph website as attention now turns to the Women's Six Nations, the Premiership, and the return of European Rugby too. If you've enjoyed the podcast over the last few weeks, please tell your friends and make sure to subscribe. From all three of us, goodbye.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.